From the Ground Up is all about us learning with you, with all these experts that we are bringing in on, from simple strategies to the most advanced property strategies. These people are all successful in what they do and have so much information to share to you, and we cannot wait for you to listen. James, it's awesome having you today, mate. It's been, about a year and a half since we first met you. It was a pin that was the first time that we met at, which was, you're probably like, we're looking at you like, wow, this teacher is now quit his job and doing these amazing developments.
Yeah.
But no, mate, so it's great to have you on here. Just give the people a little bit of an introduction on yourself, what you've been up to and what you previously did, and then we'll kind of dive into it.
Yeah. Sure. Happy to do that. Yeah. No, thanks for having me. No, it's a pleasure. And yeah, it was a pin meeting, and I think it was my second pin I'd been to, actually, having been to the Bristol one previously. So yeah, it was over in Cardiff, if I remember rightly, which is more, I know, your stomping ground. So my name's James Adams. My company, A Home, we're a residential development and investment business. I had a previous career working as a teacher. So I was a teacher for about 12 years in secondary schools. My subject's economics, so that's kind of my academic background. Taught mainly kind of 16 to 18. Quite a long story with property one way or another, but I was doing property whilst teaching. So, you know, it's a lot of people's favorite sideline, isn't it? Side hustle doing property. So I was landlording on the side, always had a development angle to the property stuff I was doing. So it wasn't just a case of kind of renting out vanilla properties. Always had kind of a development angle, doing refurbishments and that sort of thing. So I really enjoyed it. And I started in 2014. So it's been just over 10 years. And wow. About 5 years ago, so it was just exactly 5 years ago, really, because I would have stopped at the end of the academic year in 2019. So 5 years sort of full-time in property, growing the Fair Home brand, getting into some more complex projects, bigger projects from where I started out. So that's kind of where we are. We develop in Bristol primarily, although we've also done a fair bit of stuff in Manchester, which I can talk about. We're looking to develop new homes principally, but also at the same time using development as a vehicle for portfolio building as well. So quite an experienced land, primarily in HMOs. That's kind of it. That's kind of it in a nutshell.
Very cool. I love the verb landlording, first of all. I like that. That's good. So what was that sort of flipping point? Like, so 5 years, it's decent now, isn't it? You've been in it a while. What was that kind of flipping point that I'm sure so many people are in that situation, like you said, where they're doing it part-time. What was that point where you knew it was the right time to go in to it full-time?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, there were push and pull factors, really. So, you know, I really enjoyed teaching. I enjoyed lots of different aspects of it. I loved my subject. I think I was okay at it, and I got quite a kick out of, you know, helping kids get good A-levels and get into uni and that type of thing. But at the same time, I had I've got two daughters, Lola and Neve, so they're 8 and 6 now. So when I sort of left teaching, Neve was sort of 1 and Lola would have been 3. So your priorities kind of change when you become a parent, and parents would, empathize with that thing. I want to spend more time with my kids. I wanted to give them a better financial footing, I guess, in the future, you know, for our family. And teaching isn't, you know, necessarily the best way to make a lot of money. It's not really why you do the job. So there was that angle to it. I think the overhead of teaching was pretty significant. I had about 370 kids in my department across two subjects with the business as well. And you know, it's a full on job. And so there were things that I didn't like about it. So I worked in a boarding school in my last job. So I was doing 6 days, you know, at my desk at 7 on a Saturday, teaching lessons on a Saturday and stuff, which is not necessarily where I wanted to be. And I think, you know, there's a lot of overhead in terms of things like admin, dealing with parents, you know, huge email traffic, lots of marking and that type of stuff. And I'd given it a good stint in teaching. I'd done it for 12 years. So that I felt like it was time for a change. And also when I started in property, I thought, oh, I'll be able to do the property thing on the side, like in the holidays, and it will like fill up my life, because I'm quite a doer. I like to be doing things. So the holidays, weirdly, although it's kind of a reason why people like teaching, it was just too much. It was too much holiday for me, which does sound a bit odd.
That's so funny.
Trying to time it. So it was like, oh, you know, let's do a deal in the Easter holidays. You know, it just doesn't work like that, does it? You can't control the timing so well. So I was finding that being so committed to teaching meant that I couldn't really do the property stuff. And that's really where my interest lay more, I think, as I guess I got older and I started to think about the trajectory of my, you know, professional career, I suppose. So that was it really. And I'd had a small portfolio of HMOs, which obviously, you know, they're quite good for income. So I was in a position where it wasn't going to be good if I stopped my job, but I could pay the bills, you know. And definitely when you stop doing a job like I had, which is very secure, complete, no commercial risk whatsoever, with a salary, pension, you know, one of the better jobs in Bristol, probably for what I did. You definitely have a kind of, you know, year to 18 months where you're constantly like, what am I doing? How am I going, you know, financially just worried about stuff, and whether it was the right thing to do. Because you always have the feeling that you're throwing away all of the effort, all the hours that you spend doing it. And because it's such a completely different thing to be in property development to being a teacher. You know, you feel like you're kind of losing a lot, but in practice, after the kind of year to 18 months, you know, and you get a bit of traction and you start doing a few more bits, you realize, I look back now and I think actually there's a lot of transferable skills, you know, in what I do now from teaching, which might sound, you know, bit surprising, but there is a lot of skills that you pick up from teaching that are really useful to me in what I do now.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, not to mention running the networking event and teaching a whole room of people's stuff as well, right? Like that alone.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I enjoy that. Obviously, yeah, running the developers network's been a good experience, met a lot of people, but I do enjoy that aspect of it, that you know, there's a lot of risk in development. So if you can, you know, put on these events where you're getting people to, you know, tell the room about what they do, and hopefully people will kind of absorb some of that. And when they go in to do their projects, they'll be like, oh, I kind of remembered something about this, you know? So yeah, I enjoy that crossover.
We learned so much from that. I mean, that's one of the best networking. I'm not just saying that because you're on this podcast, by the way. Like, it's definitely one of the ones that we look forward to. Like, we know it's next week. Like, we look forward to that. And the venue's amazing. But what you said about the money thing, I think a lot of people don't think or talk about this when they are going into property, about like, or even just their own business, about the cash flow. Like, people think you have $1 million business, as an example, that you're like a millionaire and you have all the $1 million in there. It's just really not the case. Like, cash flow is a massive thing, and you invest so much money and time that first year, you know, especially in property development, it may take 4, 5, 6 months to actually get the first deal, but then 3, 4 months renovating it, and then maybe a month and a bit to refinance it to actually feel the reward. And it's I don't think people teach that when they do these courses or anything. It's just about, go get your deal, you'll be fine. And then there's always then the business side of it really lacks, I find, from a lot of people when they go into it, because it is business.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think, you know, people use the word kind of strategy a lot when they're, you know, talking about this sort of thing, like, what's your strategy? And it's really, you should look at it as, you know, you are running a business, so you've got to get clued up about all the aspects of running a business, really, because that's what it is. It just happens to be that what you do in your business is, you know, property related. But yeah, it's a long game, property. I think, you know, it's something that you do. You know, if you look at successful people who are in their 50s or 60s, it's easy to look and think, oh, you know, they've just acquired all these properties and it's been so easy, or they've built out schemes and it's been, you know, a breeze. But they'll have been chipping away at that for years and years and dealing with all the stress and the problems that go with it. So yeah, it's not a quick thing, I don't think.
How have you built over the last 5 years. And so obviously I imagine the big acceleration then when you went full time. Tell us a little bit about the journey from that point in 2019 to now. You've got some really cool stuff on now, which we obviously went and saw one not that long ago, a few weeks ago. So we can dive into that one as well. But yeah, tell us that kind of journey that you've been on with that.
So it started off, as I said, I with the property stuff, I didn't really ever just buy vanilla kind of buy to lets, which, you know, is a great strategy to use the word strategy, but, you know, can be a great strategy. But I always thought I really enjoy the creative aspects of development and the whole adding value process, which is really what, you know, development is all about, whether it's a piece of land or a building. So I wanted to, you know, that's always been something that I've enjoyed. So going back 5 years ago, my main sort of focus was up in Manchester in the Northwest, buying terraced houses, basically, which were inside the Article 4 area, which I'm sure people know about, but that's kind of where the council has restricted HMO development, essentially. So you need full planning rather than just doing it under permitted development. And the reason why I was focused on Manchester, because I grew up there, parents worked at the uni, so I knew the kind of student area quite well. And essentially, I was looking for very specific properties. So properties inside the Article 4 had been rented out to multiple sharers, typically three, sometimes four, that would have acquired the planning, even though it hadn't been applied for. They've effectively become an HMO through grandfathering rights, and then often through off-market sort of sourcing rights to the owners, and then turn those three beds into six beds, and always quite sort of, I guess, luxury student, I suppose, is the kind of style. It's been done quite a bit now, but going back to when I originally started sort of 10 years ago, the student stock up in Manchester was terrible, as it still is in lots of these university cities. And so I thought there was a bit of a gap in the market to make, you know, a kind of house that you'd want to live in. My cousin had been at uni in Manchester, and her like accommodation was just unbelievably bad, you know, like rising damp, penetrating damp, rats, the whole thing. So we turned these three bedders into six beds, basically, which, because it's inside the Article 4, we'd always focus on the most densely populated student areas. So we knew students would want to live there, and it's also good for revaluation, you know. So so I did several of those, and obviously just holding them through refinance, with the aim to kind of get to a position where we were, you know, as a family, let's say, financially, you know, equal to or better off than, you know, when I'd had my salaried job. Did a few of those, and as I say, all in kind of the prime student areas of Manchester. So, as I say, good for valuation, but also, you know, I've had zero voids in 10 years, apart from when we've changed over the tenants. Amazing. I like the model as well, because it's good because you've got, you know, if you're renting to groups, you know, they've all got guarantors, so your risk of not getting paid the rent, which is a big one for landlords, obviously, was very low. But also because they're in a group and they're typically mates, you know, they don't want to let each other down. So I've never had to call in a guarantor. Tenants always pay the rent. Really enjoyed sort of, you know, making really nice houses for those student groups. So yeah, I did that for sort of a couple of years after I stopped teaching. And then, I guess, ambition got the better of me, I suppose. But I knew that there were these, like, changes coming in for commercial building use. They would be associated with new permitted development rights in commercial buildings. So I wanted to kind of, if you're going to knock around a house to that extent, you might as well, buy an office and do the same, you know. So I started to think about how I could do kind of bigger deals, utilizing essentially the same kind of process, basically.
Amazing. Yeah, you went into I think it may not have been your first project. When we saw you in Pin, you were doing a really cool development, funnily enough, like out front of a school, which is ironic.
That's right.
That was your first bigger project, or did you do one before that?
Yeah, that was the first kind of big project I'd done in terms of, yeah. So it was a new build, which is obviously a different kettle of fish to doing a refurb or a conversion.
Yeah.
So that was the development was called Carlton Park. It was again, so that was sourced off market. So we basically use the planning portal to find applications that are going into Bristol Council and South Gloss, North Somerset. We look at about 10 local authorities roughly. And the homeowner there was a bungalow, and he basically applied to have a row of four houses. And I wrote a letter to him just saying, oh, you know, what are you doing with would you like to sell the site? And he didn't really have any intention of building it out. He was just doing it for planning uplift. It was a weird old bungalow, used to be part of the school, and he'd lived in it. But as I say, he just got the planning really to bump the value. So that was in about 2021. I think I originally sort of found that site. And then we sort of, after a lot of negotiation and faff trying to get it bought, knocked the bungalow down, built four three-bed townhouses there, which we sold. So we finished that in February last year, I think. The build took about 11 months, and the last house sold in sort of about a year or so ago. So they're all lived in now, with happy homeowners, hopefully. So yeah, it was a really good project.
Very cool.
And massive learning curve on the construction side, because it's obviously there's a lot more to think about. Typically, you know, the main difference, if I'm organizing a project, I use the Google environment in quite a big way. And you know, you look at the folders you might have inside a project, and you know, with an HMO job you might have, I don't know, 10, whereas within your build project folder of a new build you've got a lot more folders, if that makes sense. But the principle is kind of the same. So always keeping an eye on, you know, delivering a very good quality product. Design is something I really enjoy. So making sure that, you know, the houses are functional, and that you're adding value in ways that maybe a typical, you know, house builder might not. So, you know, things like, you know, big rooms, maybe extra ensuite storage and that sort of stuff. So yeah, it was a big learning curve. There's a lot more obviously to think about with the ground, because you're not, you know, you might do an extension or something on an HMO job, but not, you know, such extensive groundworks, I guess.
So what, so we talked about this a little bit when we saw you the other week, but what kind of makes that decision between, like for you anyway, like selling and holding something? Is there a certain type of thing you'd sell more like than others, or?
Yeah, so I think for me, I'm quite narrow in terms of what I'm trying to do. Sort of have two strands to, you know, our projects. One is things that are high yielding and throw off quite a lot of cash, which for me at the minute, that's HMOs, but open to do other things that are also, you know, make a sense from a kind of income point of view. And new homes, I guess, is, you know, you obviously when you buy it, you start a development, you buy a site, you buy it with the end in mind. And that's a bit of a cliche, but it's very true. So with Carlton Park, I never intended to hang on to those houses, because, you know, you might have various metrics you look at as to whether it's worth keeping them, like your debt coverage ratio, you know, what's your yield, how much money are you leaving in, what's your return on cash, you know, that type of thing, as well as the long-term reasons for holding, which is capital growth. And there might have been a good argument for that in the case of Carlton Park, because it was in East Bristol, which is kind of regenerating quite a lot, and you know that capital values there are only going to go one way probably. But you know, the way you design something, I guess, and how you're building it it kind of dictates the end user to a certain extent, because you might build something differently if you're doing it to sell than if you're holding it. So I definitely started with that, with the idea of just, you know, selling them, and to use the capital back into the business to go and buy more income generating assets that, you know, give you a better yield, basically. Yeah, that's the main consideration. But
that's
obviously
so
with any development, you want to have a few exits that would work. And they would have worked as rentals. It's just, you might say, it would have been a bit suboptimal, I think, particularly as interest rates moved from, I think they were 1% when I bought the site and took on the development loan, and they were 5.25% at the end. So the margin on the development loan was about 5%. So we were, we started off at 6%. We ended up at 10% or something. So if you were holding them as buy to lets, it wouldn't have been as good, you know?
Yeah. Well, I just want to, like, it's so interesting when you said about, you would have maybe designed them a bit differently if you were going to rent them. What do you think some of those differences would have been? Something like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I definitely used, for second fix related stuff, just as an example, we were quite crafty in how we did it. So, we'd source stuff. So it wasn't costing the earth, we didn't have gold doorknobs or anything, but saw stuff in quite a savvy way. But you wouldn't necessarily go to the trouble of doing all of that necessarily if it was for a rental property. A lot of the second fix related stuff was more like, this is for a homeowner, and even down to things like the architraves, skirtings, that sort of stuff. We bought more expensive second fix joinery items because we wanted to give the houses a kind of like a characterful feel. So we had like oversized OG skirts and architraves, which if you're in a rental, you just have straightforward, architraves and skirts. Yeah. So little sure. Details like that, I guess, were different. And also obviously just, number of bedrooms, apart from anything else, because we had a study there, which, if you played around with the internal wall, you could have created another bedroom because they were quite big. They're like 110 square meters, I think they were, or something. So for three beds, they were of a decent size. I think the minimum standard for a three bed over two stories is something like 85 square meters. So they were done a little bit bigger, and as I say, giving a space for a study because the kind of working from home theme was quite a thing. So we wanted just all the time thinking about adding selling points, that people would be like, oh yeah, that would work for us, and you might not do for a rental property necessarily.
Yeah, definitely. You said something that was super interesting there about the debt ratio, like comparing that. So I heard this at a speech the other day, and it was really important. They were talking about people that over leverage and all it takes is like that interest rate to like jump up a little bit. And if you're a developer and you're over leveraged, it could like completely wipe out your cash flow. Talk me through about how you're stacking that. Cause I think it's for someone trying to get into it, it's going to be very hard for them to try to predict that / understand that. And they're just going to be looking at the end number.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, for holding stuff, you want to be at sort of, 200% debt coverage ratio, really. So you want to, in other words, that your rent is twice as much as your interest payment, and I guess that is partly to give you that buffer so that if interest rates do go up, that asset you're holding, it still it still washes its face, and you've got a sufficient gap. So that when we're looking to sort of hold something, that is definitely something I'm trying to measure. The difficult thing is obviously when you get to the end of the project, you don't know what interest rates are going to be. So when you're appraising something at the beginning, you might be like, oh yeah, I can refinance this at 4.5%, but then in reality it ends up being 6.5%. So having a bit of wriggle room in that is, I think, it is a good idea. Those new builds that we did were relatively high value. So to refinance them, you'd have a decent sized mortgage, and then you're only letting them on a single AST. And you might have got, because they were very nice and they were new build and there's nothing really around like that, you might get a bit more than the three bed down the road, but you're not going to get sufficiently enough to have that kind of debt coverage ratio, I think, in terms of that metric. It's kind of good to have a buffer where there's that, sufficient gap between what you're paying every month and what's coming in from the rent.
That's a little nugget for people listening.
Yeah, I know you guys were into serviced accommodation, because that obviously a lot of people started getting into that when interest rates started going up and landlords repurposing buy-to-lets into SA. And, I really, really looked at that because it was another option to get out of the deal, because obviously the key the absolutely key thing is getting out of, getting off the development finance loan, stabilizing the whole thing, because costs are eye-watering when you're on peak debt. So I did look at that, but I suppose a downside with that site was you were a little bit limited on options, because SA, as you know, it can work everywhere, but it will work at different price points and for different end users. So there you would have probably had, you know, the contractor type market there. But it's tricky, because when you're refinancing lenders, you know, not all lenders are sort of comfortable with that. If you go for, you know, short stay type debt, it's more expensive. But yeah, that would have been an option as a way of kind of pushing up the, you know, the rent and keeping that coverage. But as it was, I didn't have to go down that road, and yeah, got them all sold, which is good.
Yeah, it's a good point though, because it is something where we do work with clients like that sometimes, where it might be something that they're doing for a certain amount of time as sort of their exit strategy, but you know, it's not maybe forever, but it might be something that they've got up their sleeve if they need to increase the pressure on it. So yeah, it's a good point. But like you said, if you've designed them in a way where, you know, it's not really suitable for contractors, but then contractors are the market there, then you kind of, your maintenance costs probably aren't really like worth it, you know?
Yeah. And there's a big difference, isn't there, probably between the way you'd optimally, if you were a new build serviced accommodation, you'd build it in a certain way. Whereas if you're selling to my kind of avatar with those houses was people in their early 30s who were not first time buyers, but they were first house buyers. So they maybe lived in a flat, you know, and they were coupling up and then they were buying a house together. That was exactly who bought the houses, and what they want in a house is really different to, okay, now we're going to have contractors in this, like on a Monday to Friday thing. It's really different. And actually even down to things like, you know, your first fix, like, cause your sockets would be in a certain position probably for that avatar, but they would need to be something different, you know, if you were going to make it a proper purpose built serviced accommodation type unit. So it wouldn't have been the ideal way of doing it. The only benefit would be that, you know, potentially you're making more income from it, albeit that it'd be potentially variable income. But yeah,
and right now you've obviously got like capital allowance and that kind of side of it, which is nice for developers. Things like that are changing, but that can twist people in a certain direction, you know. That can help, but we always say, like, you know, you're not stacking a deal off of that.
That's the cherry on the top. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's going to be removed. I mean, the other thing that really pushed people to service accommodation was like removing of the section 24. Yeah. I got it right. Yeah. Which was like a massive one. But a really interesting thing that people do is I heard someone doing this. This is like their whole business model. Really weird. It's like a void strategy for service accommodation. So what they do is they work with developers and they basically run it as service accommodation until either they rent it or they sell it. And basically, they just keep topping up the maintenance, and they're making like money. So it's covering the mortgage, but it's obviously you know, they just keep having to like maintain stuff, which is really interesting. When I heard that, I was like, sure, that doesn't work. But this person said he had like a block of 100, and he was run that for like a couple of months, and I was like, stacked up the management on that. I was like, wow, that is interesting strategy, very interesting strategy. So when you jumped from this one, did you go straight into Willow Tree? So that's the one that you, I was going to say done, but it's
So after that one, I bought a property in Filton in North Bristol, which was a 3-bed semi-detached house on a big plot. So we basically converted the 3-bed into quite a high-end HMO. The idea was to diversify a little bit away from students. So we did kind of, you know, like all en suites, large bedrooms. It was, we did like a 6x5 meter extension, dormer extension, and ended up with a sort of seven bed there. And then there was a garage to the side, which we demolished and did a new build on the side. Wow. So it's just added on to the terrace effectively, and that's a purpose built HMO essentially. So It's four beds, I say all en suite, really, really nice. And with that one, because it's very close to kind of, you know, the engineering hub up there. So you've got Airbus around the corner and Rolls-Royce, GKN, BAE, and all of the other businesses that are up there. The idea was maybe to have a kind of hybrid where the seven bed you do on a, you know, you do on a typical traditional AST model. And then the four bed would be almost like a, kind of like a little mini, like a little mini hotel type thing, you know, for contractors and potentially get a blue chip tenant who would, you know, put their workers in there. So it's a very nice HMO. So it's a new build HMO, which is quite kind of a bit unusual, I guess, because people tend to convert rather than doing them from scratch. But so it's 11 beds in total, lot of bathrooms. So yeah, there was a lot of bathrooms going on. The M&E side of it was quite interesting. But yeah, working really well. I finished that in May of this year, and that is now refinanced. It's rented out. So we've got seven professional sharers in the big house and then four doctors in the new build. Because, nice. Yeah, positioning wise, it's great because you've got, aside from the engineering, you've got Southmead Hospital, which is about, I don't know, a couple of hundred meters down the road. So it works really well. And obviously, doctors, you know, good so far, good tenants, but, you know, they're quite focused on their work. So, you know, they're not partying till 3 a.m. every day. And, trashing your house, but that worked well. It was quite a complex project though, to be honest. It was, you know, with a conversion, there's a lot to, you always unearth things that you didn't anticipate being there, so you end up having to do quite a lot of extra work. Even things like the drainage were quite complicated, the levels at the back were not straightforward. So and that's one that we just holding on to that in the portfolio basically. But yeah, it was a good project. So yeah, good location inside the Article 4 now as well. So hopefully it will, you know, it will be good in the long run. It will be a good asset in terms of value as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
How many projects do you have on like a go at a time? Like, do you tend to do one big one at a time? Or do you try and have like, I think you mentioned a couple of months ago at the networking event, you have a few smaller type things on the side as well.
So because the timing, the bigger developments, you, if you look at it from when you like, you say you find the site to where you're exiting, it's going to be like, for a new build thing, it's like, you know, it's like 18 months like or more, you know, and if you're stuck in planning, it could be, you know, a million years. So you can't just be doing that. So for me, I want to do things which are like a bit quicker to do and a bit less overhead in terms of financing. You know, the planning might be easier. So, and it just keeps you moving because, you know, I'm still relatively early in my, you know, property career, and I consider myself, you know, a relative beginner with a lot to learn. And I just want to keep moving and doing good projects and, you know, completing them, paying off the lender, getting them tenanted or getting them sold, because that's how you know you build up your brand and your experience, really, you know. So
yeah,
so yeah, we since then, so pretty much immediately after that, bought another, was a sort of very knackered three bed house, which I finished today. Tenants are moving in tomorrow. Yeah, we had it sort of this week's been a bit hectic because we had the guy, you know, valuation was this morning. We had professionally shot on, I think it was on Wednesday, he'd staged and all that. So been a bit hectic, but yeah, so that's now six beds. So we did like a rear extension, loft conversion, and yeah, it's six professionals in there. So yeah, they move in tomorrow. That's in Bristol. And that was 20 weeks from start to finish. So it's just quite easy, you know, not too much overhead. I think with the bigger developments, there's a lot of problem solving going on all the time. And it's like, oh God, we've got to do this. And then we've got this problem. How are we going to deal with that? You know, so whereas with something like that, it's relatively more straightforward. So you can just, you know, you tick off another one and it's something that you can show to your investors. You can show it to, you know, your peers, and they know, they can see that you're doing stuff, and you know, you've ticked off another project. So we've done that one since the big HMO job. And the bigger one is Willow Tree Apartments, which you guys have been to, which I bought in November last year. And we should Yeah, yeah, it's a big lump. Yeah, yeah, 8,000 square foot. Yeah, 8,000 square foot ex care home, which was very grotty, but is starting to take shape. Obviously, you guys have been down there. We should be done.
Yeah, looking good.
Hoping we'll have some people living there, you know, for Christmas is the plan. But
was there? It was 11 weeks when we were there. How's that 11 week schedule going? Are you still on track?
We've got a lot of guys on site now. So some of the team that were working on the smaller job I've just done, we're kind of moving them over for a few weeks. Because there's just a lot to do. You know, we've got obviously a lot of outside space there. So you've got to start thinking about your landscaping, external works, as well as actually, you know, getting the looking like flats rather than a building site. Which it does feel like a building site at the minute. But yeah, it's coming on.
It definitely feels like a building site. Yeah, but it's interesting when we're doing our first one, like, it's nowhere near, it's like 1/10 or even 1/20 of what you're doing, but you kind of see the transformation and like how slowly it goes. But then I feel like the last little bit, it looks like crap, but then all of a sudden, like some skirting boards, you paint, and all of a sudden it just becomes a house, just like within a week or two, which is just like...
Definitely, and I think with new build, the difference with new build is when you're doing some new build, it flies up really quickly. You know, like I don't know, you've got your brickies on site, and they're chucking down loads of blocks a day, and all of a sudden, you know, you're up to first lift, and you're like, wow, everything's happening. Whereas with a conversion, you know, like, it feels dingy, like when you're in there, because everything's been ripped out, and you know, you've got just kind of like the lighting's terrible, and it's feels quite attritional. So you go to sign, you're like, has anything actually happened since I was here last week? You know, but there's a lot of kind of the innards of those, you know, of flats when you're converting. It takes a lot of time, you know, to bring it together. And obviously, when you get your dry liners in, and walls always make it feel better, don't they? You know, we've got some walls to bedroom now, you know,
you start visualizing, so
attritional.
It's like the
that's so cool.
Like what we've done, like Zach said, it's a house. We're refurbing a house, right? So it's obviously not the same thing, but we're learning so much from doing it. And I think, like there's that kind of like we've built a decent size extension on the back, and that happened so fast. I was like, wow, oh my god, it's flying. And then it kind of slowed down with kind of electrics, plumbing, like the kind of juicy things that are behind the scenes that are really boring, and you're like, oh, amazing.
And plastering.
Right.
I went to site today, and you know, like we've got a drainage run that's gone in, and you know, it's just somebody's had to dig a hole, you know, through a slab, and it's hideous work and takes forever and is back breaking. But it's crucially important, because otherwise the toilet, you know, you can't get your waste out.
Yeah.
So that's progress, but it's not as exciting as, oh, the walls have been painted, you know, or the doors have been hung or something, you know, it's not quite as exciting, but it all has to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so true. You know how you got your two projects on, you got like different multiple ones, you got your bigger one, which is like, what time, like if you were to think about like the last 6 months with the smaller one, the bigger one going on, what where's your time kind of going to? Like if you were to break it down like a percentage wise.
Yeah, I mean, massively towards the bigger one, it's probably like 80-20, you know, on the smaller job, it's like, you know, you've obviously got your design phase where you're thinking about, which really matters when you're doing an HMO conversion, because you've got to, you know, we don't do really small bedrooms. It's just, you know, we don't want pokey rooms. We want them to be designed well. And so that phase, you're quite involved in it, and you're doing your electrical plan and thinking like where the beds are going to go, where your sockets need to go. And that type of thing, you know, there's input there. But, you know, in terms of actual problems on site, like, you know, I don't have the contractor ringing me up and being like, oh, how do we solve this problem? Or how do we solve that problem? Or, you know, this is a bit of an unknown, because it's, you know, once you've set up the design side of it, it's kind of like a press play thing almost. You know, there's the odd thing where you might need to take a decision on something. Whereas with the bigger one, you've got multiple flats, they're all different in layout, but also we're selling them. So you've got a freehold there, and you've got to split the title. You've got to think about how the lease, what's the arrangement going to be between the freehold and the leaseholders? What does that look like? What rights do you grant them? What's the service budget going to be? All the way through to things like, the brochure. You guys have seen the brochure. So you've got to think, the copy that goes into that. What images are we going to use? What fonts do we use? What colors are we going to use? So there's just a lot more things to think about on that. So it's definitely takes up more time, for sure. But it's a bigger project. So the GDV on that side, say 2.7 million, whereas the HMA I've just done might be like 100,000. So it's reflected in the value, I guess, of the project to some extent, and how complex it is.
And how have you, like we said at the beginning about building it as a business, which is super interesting, because like when you're saying that, these projects take a long time, you see people on social media talking about, like you just said, this amazing like GDV, but then you've got to think about your like hourly rate, like your time in a year, right? And like you're actually working on it for that and not tying everything up into it. So you're stuck for years. Yeah. So how do you structure it as a business? Like, do you have any other, like, people, do you have team members? Like, how do you?
Yeah, so I've got two assistants that work for me. So one does kind of admin and property management. So, she's completely proficient with ASTs and the prescribed info, lodging deposits, referencing tenants and that sort of thing. There's a lot of comms with tenants, and that's helpful because I don't really need to be doing that. And it's taking me away from more, I guess, higher value stuff. And then my other assistant purely does site finding. So she's business development manager. So she does, we look at about 100 sites a month, roughly. Because that's the kind of volume you need to look at to, if you're doing off-market sourcing, you need to look at a lot of sites. And then otherwise it's all, consultants and subcontractors. I'm at the point now where I'm sort of probably going to take on kind of a, an executive PA. So like, kind of like a mini me, I suppose. And somebody young who's quite hungry, wants to learn, and will probably get a lot from, the experience. And also it will help me to delegate, some of that. But also I pay myself from the project. So the projects pay, I've got a trading company, which is effectively a consultancy business. So, we'll pay development management fees from the development to that company. And that kind of covers off a lot of business expenses that we have, like paying this, paying people that I work with me, and running, just running costs of a business. Like running business costs money, doesn't it? My marketing manager, pays for my marketing manager every month, and it covers off some of my time, because really you should charge for your time, Definitely when you're doing smaller stuff, like with the HMO one, the smaller HMO I've just done, I didn't pay myself with that because it wasn't really taking up a huge amount of my time. And it's kind of, smaller deals don't have the meat of them to justify it. I pay myself development management fees. We also do contract administration as well. So when you're doing drawdowns from the bank, I deal with all of that side of it as well. So you have, you look at your costs that you've got, your contract sum analysis and how much you're drawing down each month, doing payment certificates and stuff. So I kind of done that deliberately so that there's a cash flowing business there, which is my consultancy, which is effectively how I pay myself, if that makes sense.
That's interesting.
The banks are absolutely fine with it. And it's definitely for people that are thinking of getting into development, even if it's something quite small, you should always have a line for, what you're paying yourself. And then granted, your payment is, in a way, hopefully you make some profit, although it's not guaranteed. But it's month to month, isn't it? We've all got month to month things. So within the business, it's paying the people that work for me, paying for marketing costs and that sort of stuff. And it's very helpful for that reason. Definitely paying yourself. But, we're all guilty of that, I think, of not paying ourselves. When you run your own business, you see it as a way of saving money, but it ends up being that you do a lot of work for free, which I was very used to as a teacher, incidentally, because you when you're a teacher. But I'm kind of getting out of that mindset a bit more now. So
interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. Have you Have you read the oh god, the book has slipped my mind. What's it called, Eve? The book about paint. Have you read Profit First, the book?
Haven't, but it sounds like I should.
It's a good book. Yeah. So it's what you talked about, where business owners, like small business owners, they don't pay themselves. They for some reason, like you said, what they do is they pay all their expenses, and then all of a sudden they look at their spreadsheet and that's what their profit is for the month. But to give you like the summary, the author basically used to do this all the time, ran a business, was like a multi-million dollar business, and then got to the end of the year. He's like had barely any money in his bank account. He's like, what's going on? And the accountant said, here you go, you got a 40 grand tax bill. He didn't have the money. And he's like, but I there's no money. He's like, yeah, you made an accountancy profit. He's like, what? Yeah. He's like, well, how's that work? I got no money. And basically then he talks about like you as soon as money comes in, you like basically put it into a separate account, like multiple different accounts. So it's something that I adopted early because my mentor told us, and it's like amazing. So we had a massive like VAT bill the other day. It was just like a click of the button. Like I didn't even think about it. It wasn't stressful. Whereas I know so many people are like panicking that they got a VAT coming. So you kind of remind me of that. It's super interesting because I think, I think people don't pay themselves enough. I definitely didn't pay myself enough early days until I got forced to. Until my mentor's pay yourself something. You're working.
I think that's right. I mean, accountants and economists look at profit differently, don't they? So an accountant doesn't take into account opportunity cost. And, you know, the opportunity cost is what you need to cover off. It's just got to be, done. But, at the same time, there's sweat equity, isn't there? You know, you running your own business is partly the grafting and doing the long hours and working on a Sunday, because in the longer run, you just have to get it done because you're dependent on yourself, I guess.
100%, yeah. What is the end in mind kind of for you, James? Like, you know, you're doing all these amazing projects, you know, clearly doing fantastic right now. Where's the next 5 years take you? Do you got that vision?
I mean, my simple thing was when I stopped teaching, I sort of give myself 10 years and then see where I was and you know, because like I said at the beginning, I'm quite a doer. Like I'm not one for sitting around twiddling my thumbs. So, but to be in a position where the bills are taken care of, you know, and I don't have any ambitions to be doing, honestly, like, you know, 100 unit schemes and stuff like this. I want to manage risk quite carefully and hopefully at the end of 10 years have a decent portfolio that my kids will benefit from and that will kind of pay for the bills and give us a decent lifestyle, you know, some nice holidays, have our house, have our family home as we want it to have it and really just be a master of my own time. You know, that's the thing is time is finite, isn't it? So, you know, if you can be in a position where you've got more choice over what you do with your time, that's a massive gift, you know? So I'm kind of working towards that. And that's something I really enjoy doing what I'm doing now compared to teaching, because although you've got all those holidays, it's very rigid. So you're literally ruled by a bell, you know, or if the bell's going, I've got this from 3 or what have you. Whereas now, you know, on a Tuesday, if I want to go for coffee, 10:43, I go for coffee. If I want to do a podcast with you guys at what time is it? 3:42 on Friday, it's okay. That I'm not going to get bothered. Yeah. One manager. So,
it's so valuable. And it's the thing that people kind of coin as like financial freedom, which is not true in the sense you're not doing, you know, nothing with your time sitting around, but it's the choice, isn't it? I think that's a much better way of explaining it. Like for me, a big one was my mum's 50th on a Wednesday, and I could spend it with her. Yeah. On a Wednesday in the day, you know, like that's just so valuable. I mean that is like the ultimate kind of goal, isn't it? Whatever that lifestyle looks like at that point is kind of irrelevant. But if you can get to that point and do what you want to be doing, then that's great, isn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah. So true. You know what's funny is like I remember when we quit our job or I quit my job, and the first day, you know, it was my normal routine where I went to the gym and it was the first time I was like, oh, I don't actually have to rush back from the gym to shower and eat and then get to work at 9. So I just went to a coffee shop and just like ordered a coffee and just sat down there at like 9 o'clock just because I was like, no one else gets to do this. it's just like, you know, and it was just like this, like really, and I called my mum back home in Australia, and I was like, this is awesome. And I think people like have that, like, because there's so many people that want to quit their job, and I go to so many networking events, and they don't know how to do it. They're all talking about doing these things, and I see these people, and this is probably leading to a question, like, what would you tell someone that's just constantly saying they want to quit their job, they want to get into property, but they're just kind of kicking the can down the road? What would your kind of wisdom or words be to them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the interesting thing is people talk about like property as a cash flow thing, which I've always found a bit strange, because actually property is terrible for cash flow because it's very liquid. But I think what people mean is that you can replace your salary from the job you hate through another means and give you that freedom. And I think it's partly it's think carefully about why you want to do it. I mean, for me, I don't do what I do. It sounds like I'm lying, but I'm not. I'm not really that motivated by money, which sounds a bit weird, because obviously you're running a business and it is about making money. But you've got to, you know, as I said, like I really enjoy the creative aspects of development. I like turning ugly ducklings into, you know, beautiful swans. Is that a right thing? That's kind of like a species change. But anyway, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we'll run with it.
That's it. Yeah, let's go with it. But yeah, so that I really enjoy that, and you know, the multifaceted side to development. You know, it's finance, it's design, it's quite creative, it's negotiation. You know, and that's really what I enjoy doing. And for me, like the brand delivering a good product is really, really important. It's about getting a good job done. You know, that's really what motivates me. So people need to think carefully about that, because actually a job is your best cash flow strategy, to use the word strategy again, because your job gives you money every single month. And some, you know, the idea of like just quitting your job and going, oh, yeah, I'm going to be a property developer is like, I think, you know, you need to be a bit cautious with that. Because development especially is not good for cash flow. You know, it's actually terrible for cash flow, because you've constantly got cash going out. And then occasionally you get cash coming in, but you know, as a cash flow cycle, it's not great. So, and also like it goes back to those push and pull things. Like, are you trying to do this because you hate your job? You know, and are you just doing the wrong job? Like, is there something else? And I think honestly, because like you, you know, I've been to quite a few networking things, meet a lot of people through the developers network who come along. And sometimes I think it's people are looking for something because they're not happy. And they don't like their boss, or they're bored, or they feel like they're not achieving what they want to achieve. And you know, it might be actually when you're assessing what you're doing, you're just doing the wrong job, and you need to have like a bit of a change there. And you know, I think doing it as a side hustle is a good idea. You know, to kind of learn, get more experience, keep the stability of a job, and then you know, see how it goes. But people do, like, you know, as you know, they get one HMO and they're like, you know, I'm tapping out of my job, and it's living a bit
it's risky.
It's crazy. And actually you need to have a lot of property producing a lot of income to get yourself to, you know, let's say like, I don't know, a 30, 40, 50 grand job. You need to have quite a lot of income coming in. You know, if you're, I don't know, your gross rent's 100 grand, what's your margin on it, you know? And then you can factor in tax and all the rest of it. So yeah, there's a little bit, I think people sometimes look at it as a bit of you know, it's all sweet when you're doing property, but it's a profession like any other, with its ups and downs, and just need to think quite carefully about it. But if you really enjoy property, I think you have to enjoy property. You know, like I like talking to people about property. I'm so boring. You know, I always have to, like, when I go meet people, just, my wife doesn't quite tell me, but she's almost like, just don't start talking about planning at the table, because you know, people don't so care. You care about it. Other people don't care about it.
You've got to be passionate. Yeah, you totally do. And you know what I think as well is, it's like, it is that dream of like, oh, quitting your job. And like you said, people looking at that for all of the amazing reasons. But actually the reality of what those first few years at least look like and beyond,
yeah,
it's not easier. Like, it's it's different. It's so different. It's not about comparing them, but it's just such a different thing, isn't it? And like you said, you're relying on yourself. So it isn't 9 to 5 and you don't really ever switch off. But that's great. And when you're doing something that you're passionate about, then that doesn't feel like a job. And I think that's the best thing. Like, I can't wait till we start doing, you know, these kinds of things. Like, we've built this business that's amazing, and it's the cash flow business that we love and we don't want to get rid of. But then there's the profit plays and the asset building. I mean, when I was little, I used to make my mum take me to show homes and stuff. Like, that was what I wanted to do for fun on the weekend. And I would draw like floor plans in my spare time as a kid. So yeah, you've kind of got to love it, like you said. So it's
And actually, having a trading business is really good, like, you know, which you guys do, for all the reasons, you know, it has lots of benefits to it. Same reason why, you know, I've got a trading business. Actually, if you're doing development, you know, what value is there in a development business? You know, and then when you start thinking of exit, like at the end, you know, how do you exit? Because your development business doesn't really have any value, you know, and that's why. You know, I get, you know, when I see developers who've also got a construction arm, that just makes so much sense to me. Like, you know, sometimes having a construction business, I think it's like a headache, but it's kind of like a necessary evil. But that has value in it, you know, brings in money. You're doing client work, and then you can do your developments on the side. And obviously, it's operationally very similar. So that makes a lot of sense. You know, when I speak to build, like, people who are in the trades who wanted to start doing development, it kind of makes sense because they understand the delivery process, but they're also continuing to do their job in a way, you know.
It's money, good verticals so. There for sure. Yeah, it's valuable to use those, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think, I love the conversation when it comes to business and property because, yeah, we're the same. We're quite boring. We just talk about business. But you know, it's funny. If you said you were doing that, I was probably just playing video games and playing like football. Like, that's my childhood. I probably wasn't even it. Probably wasn't even an oversight. I was like, I should probably just buy a property and just.
Yeah, no. I was more nerdy than that on the.
Yeah, I funnily enough, I genuinely before Eve mentioned property, I genuinely didn't think about doing it. I was like, oh yeah, just buy a house and you have a typical buy to let kind of model, which I inevitably realized very quickly that I could do one every like 5 years at the current rate that I was earning. I was like, that doesn't seem like it's going to be a good plan. I mean, this has been super interesting. What are you getting up to now after this Willow Tree? We didn't actually talk about Willow Tree that much, but we obviously went through a little bit. Talk quickly about that as a like a breakdown of what you're currently doing there. Like how many flats and probably what the biggest learning point from that property was, well, that new build or conversion to that new build.
So it was a disused care home, been empty for 5 years, quite big. It was 32 beds, 8,000 square foot on a very big plot. Bought it with planning through an agent, and the attraction of that was that it had planning and it was kind of ready to go. So given the way the planning is a total disaster zone at the minute, as you know, and people know, it was really attractive as something that was kind of ready to go. Very good location, right in the center of town. Would work for the demographic around there because we're selling to downsizers mainly. So having that proximity to this kind of shopping center is a good thing. It's 9 flats, 7 3-beds, 2 2-beds. I think that's right. So the GDV is about 2.7 million, something like that. Build is about £1 million, ballpark. So,
beast.
It was, you know, it's been a good learning experience. I think, you know, things I already knew, but have definitely been good learning points. Like, you know, when you're thinking about your costs, you need to think very broadly about them. So you've obviously got your build cost, which is the main bit. But at the same time, you need to think about working capital in your development company that owns it. So, you know, I'm sure you know, I've got a holding company. The holding company owns shares in the project companies. And that those little project companies, they need to be properly capitalized. So, you know, you just have cash. You need to spend money, which is not to do with building stuff. It could be, I don't know, like, you know, we've got micro sites, for example, for... that people can log on to when they scan the QR on our advertising board. And that, you know, every month, there's a little fee that we have, hosting fees. We had to pay somebody to do the website. We had to pay somebody to do the brochure. You've got, you know, utilities costs all the way through. You've got to insure the building. You've got post-completion costs because, you know, even things like, getting postal addresses, you know, it costs money to do it. So that's one big thing. VAT is another big thing. So VAT is hideously complicated, as you probably know. But, you know, when you're doing something like that, your charge on the actual build is 5% because it's conversion. But you need to think about who's paying what. Is the construction company paying for things, or is the SPV paying for things? And you know, when you're dealing with quite a bit of money, the VAT bill goes up quite a bit. So you need to do that, like manage that quite efficiently. I think those have been two things that have been sort of reinforced, and you know, that I think I've learned about there. And again, just learning more about, you know, selling new homes is a skill, you know, knowing how to do it, when to do your marketing, thinking about who your avatar is, who's going to buy them, the price point you're selling them for. And those things, you know, I've gained some more experience on sort of new home development, which has been good as well. So yeah, it's been a good, yeah, it's good, good project so far. Lots of learning, a bigger build job, obviously. And utilities, oh my God, it's so expensive. It's just crazy. So our new electric. our new electric connection alone was $22,000. You know, it's just like,
that's crazy. Yeah,
it's mad. You've got to pay that, and you're not getting any money in from revenue. You just got to find the funding for it. So structuring the deal was, I learned quite a bit as well. So we funded that through equity and also through debt. So we have shareholders who are basically taking on more risk, but they're going to get a better kind of return. And we've also got junior debt and we've got senior debt as well. So financially, you know, how that all is tied together in a shareholders agreement and the articles of association, that was also a good learning experience as well for future projects. It's been a good project. We're just about to exchange on a new project. So timing wise, it's been quite good. As I said, finished the HMO today, hopefully exchanging another one today. So and again, it's not a huge deal, but it's one that I think it'll be quite quick, and another one ticked off, different sort of project again. So hopefully we'll learn from that as well.
Sounds like a bit of a celebration this Friday.
It's Friday. It's Friday.
You gotta. Very good Friday.
You get on the beers while we pack. We're gonna move fast.
Yeah, we're moving house tomorrow. So crazy. Just before we finish, I just want to do an extra, you know, shout out to the developers. It's also, we've been going there for a while. And I just want to highlight it again because, like Zach said, it's such a great networking event. It's really great room of people. Like, it's just, you just, yeah, such a valuable room, and everyone's so, so interesting and shares so much knowledge in there. And the speaker's always really good. Really looking forward to the next one with the, can tell us again who it is exactly.
Yeah, it's
really
Mike and Carrie McKeown from Matrix Group. So Mike and Carrie, I've known for a little while. They've run various property businesses. So they ran and sold an estate agency. So they've done all of that type of stuff. Mike's done some quite lumpy developments, new build. Carrie's like very kind of systemized, organized. And they've got quite a significant serviced accommodation business. They also do serviced accommodation operations like you guys do for clients as well. So they're good business people, understand property pretty well, and have done quite a lot of different things from buy to let properties to being an estate agent to doing new build to serviced accommodation, and lovely people to boot as well. So I think they'll have quite an interesting story, and they're obviously looking to combine their, I guess, let's say the cash flowing type thing, the high yielding thing of serviced accommodation alongside, you know, new build and conversion, and doing it for that purpose. So it's quite interesting. I don't know lots of people who are doing it. So, and I think it's something that people are definitely interested in, serviced accommodation, and they're definitely interested in developments. So hopefully sort of bringing the two together should be a good event.
Yeah. We'll
awesome.
We'll leave the link for it. in the description because it is a good one. Anyone around Bristol? No, I mean, we travel an hour from Cardiff to come, so it's good. It's worth it.
Yeah. But no, James, it's been awesome. Made some little value here. So we'll put all James' details in the description if you want to reach out to James or even get involved in some of these some of these projects that are going on. He's got another HMO. Maybe you can get involved. Reach out to him. But yeah, it's been a pleasure, mate, to keep smashing. You're doing fantastic things.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.